Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Yesterday, the International Ocean Film Festival concluded a successful three-day run in San Francisco, showcasing ocean-themed films encapsulating how we can protect, restore, and celebrate the ocean for generations to come. And even though the in-person portion of the festival is concluded on Sunday, there's still time to see many of the films online up until April 22nd, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And today we're going to discuss one of the documentaries that was featured, Until the End of the World. The film takes viewers on an epic visual journey through Europe, Africa, and South America to investigate the fastest growing food production industry in the world, fish farming. It focuses on the challenges that this multi-billion dollar industry has created for communities who have depended on fishing and tourism for their livelihood. The industry has been marketed as a viable and sustainable answer for food security for an increasingly growing global population. But is it? So here to talk more about that, we are very pleased to be joined by Francesco DeAugustinis, who is the director of Until the End of the World. Francesco is an award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker with more than a decade experience in food and environmental issues, and founder of the media project One Earth, a nonprofit working to accelerate collective action to solve climate crisis through groundbreaking science, inspiring media, and an innovative approach to climate philanthropy. So good to have you with us, Francesco, and congratulations on the film.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me, and nice to talk with you about the documentary.
Well, we're also pleased to be joined for at least the first part of the show by Anna Blanco, who is the executive director for the International Ocean Film Festival and also the co-director of the new short documentary Sequoias of the Sea, which explores the challenges facing our disappearing sea forests. So good to have you with us, Anna.
Thank you for having me, Ethan. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Anna, congratulations on another successful festival, as well as your own documentary. So the festival, as I mentioned, just concluded yesterday, and I just wanted to hear from you. What was the highlight of this year's festival from your perspective?
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Ethan. I would have to say that, we just had so many people attending the festival, not only for the films, but for the panel discussions. We had four of those over the weekend, but it was just so visibly well attended. Our numbers are back up after the pandemic. This is our third festival in person, and there was just an excitement in the air and a real eagerness to learn from the films and experience the film. So I think the community of people who were at the festival really felt engaged and really felt like they had an opportunity to meet the filmmakers, learn more, and just really walk away with inspiration on what to do next.
Well, Anna, that's wonderful to hear. And of course, oceans play in a really critical role in helping the world address the climate crisis. Oceans are obviously extremely vulnerable because of climate change. And I'm just wondering what stood out for you in terms of maybe some common themes across the documentaries. Were there a common set of solutions or new science that came out? What really stood out to you if there were any themes that ran across some of these films?
You know, I think the themes that stood out for me the most are what we're talking about today with Francesco about industrial fish farming and just what's happening on a global scale. And I think so much of that is as the movie shows, it's perceived to be one of the solutions, but the film obviously just shares how it's hard to be sustainable. The other film that came out that we showed on opening night is entitled Blue Carbon and Nature's Hidden Superpower, I should say. And it just gave us an opportunity to learn more about blue carbon, the blue economy, and just what's on the horizon for how we can protect our oceans.
And Francesco, as Anna mentioned, that your film was part of this theme. I'm also just curious, just generally, before we talk about your documentary, if there's more that could be done to really raise awareness about what's happening with oceans in relation to the climate crisis. And obviously film festivals like this can play an important role, but just your thoughts, Francesco, about at a bigger picture, what needs to be done to raise awareness about what's happening in the oceans?
But yes, I think that the more attention is absolutely needed. And I've seen so many great documentaries during the festival. I've been attending all the screenings almost. And there were so many themes and sensitive problems that are not very known by the large audience. So I think that it's so important to talk more about the problems, but it's so important to also talk about the real solutions. No, my documentary try to investigate on solutions, even if at the end of the day it comes out to be probably a fake solution, the fish farming, but it's suggested as a solution. And the other documentaries have been talking a lot about marine protected areas that are a very effective solution. Also the blue carbon documentary that Anna mentioned before was something that was investigating solution. So I think that we need to talk more about the problems, and we think to know more about the real solution, because the solutions are there. We just have to follow them, to make them real.
And Francesco, I know that you are here in San Francisco to attend the festival. I also wanted to ask you, what really jumped out at you? What were some of the highlights for you with the film festival?
But I don't know. What I saw is such a difference between what I've told in my work and the reality that so many films were showing, because there were so many wonderful documentaries showing ecosystems in a so fragile balance, ecosystems so dangerous by, especially by climate change, but not only by climate change, by fishing, by so many problems that are affecting our oceans. And on the other hand, I've been there with my documentary that was showing people talking about increasing production of fish, increasing production of impactful productions. So for me, it was really like speaking to different languages, no? Seeing so many fragile balances and so many effort by small communities all around the world that are trying to restore their fragile local ecosystems. And on the other hand, seeing industries, governments sometimes, and in the case of my story, they also the UN, that are advocating for increasing production of farms, intensive farms, is something that is kind of, something that really is strange for me, no? It's like they are talking different languages and talking about different things.
Well, that kind of contradiction, I think, is really just inherent with this kind of issue with oceans in general, and just the state of awareness and peril that we're in. And Ana Blanca, I know that you are, we're going to let you go in a minute here. So I just wanted to not let you go without asking you just, in terms of those who couldn't attend in person, the International Ocean Film Festival, how can they watch some of these films now online? And also, what are your plans for future events? What are the next steps here for the festival and your work in this field?
Oh, that's a great question, Ethan. So today, our virtual film screening starts. So many of the films that were available at the film festival are now available online virtually. We've also added some films. So anybody who wants to see some new films that were at the festival, there's plenty to choose from there as well. Francesco's film is on Until the End of the World. I highly recommend it. And we also have our student film competition. So we have an annual student film competition where students from around the world submit their films that are 5 minutes or less about the ocean, and they're just remarkable films. It's amazing what these young students have to say. They're high school and middle school students. So I highly recommend that. And some of the programs that are on the virtual platform have 3 or 4 films within them. So you could perhaps pick something that's about marine wildlife, program number 5. You click on it and you get 5 great films. So there's lots to choose from. There's something for everyone. And the virtual film festival lasts from April 15th to April 22nd. To answer your second question, you know, right around the corner in June 8th is World Ocean Day. So we have a lot of partners that are showing our films in Florida, across the country. We have a sister city partnership with Kiel, Germany. They have their version of an ocean film festival in a couple of weeks. And so there's lots to, there's just, you know, it's the ocean needs our attention. There's always opportunity to see more films, and we're grateful for filmmakers like Francesco who choose to tell the stories that they tell.
Well, absolutely. And we're grateful for you as well for your work on this important issue. And Anna Blanco, Executive Director for International Ocean Film Festival and also co-director of the new short documentary, Sequoias of the Sea. Thank you so much for coming on Your Call. Congratulations again on the festival. And we hope to have you back on to hear more about this issue.
Thank you so much, Ethan.
All right. And Francesco, let me go back to you and talk about your documentary, Until the End of the World. First, let's just start with how this idea came to you. How did you discover this issue and sort of get a lead that this might be an important topic for you to cover in a documentary format?
Yes, thank you. As you mentioned in your introduction to me, I've been working on food and environmental issues. It's been 10 years. I've been working on these issues, and this is my third documentary, and the previous documentary was focusing on the incredible increase worldwide of livestock production, so land animals farmed on land. And then a few years ago, while we were promoting that film, we met a lot of news talking about green money supposed to support green projects from the EU and from other international institutions being given to other factory farms that were in the sea. They were fish factory farms. And this was really strange for us because we were investigating for many years factory farms, and it was very strange to hear that money supposed to support green projects was given to farms, even if they were farms in the sea. So we decided to look better to this kind of production, and because the idea was to find out if it was a real solution, as it was suggested by the industry by some international institution, including the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, to make the food system more sustainable. And so this was the beginning of our journey. The film is a story of a journey that starts in the Mediterranean countries, especially in Greece, that is together with the Turkey is the biggest producer of farmed fish in the Mediterranean. They especially farm sea bream and sea bass in the sea. To follow this industry and to try to understand if it's a real solution as the industry say of itself, or if it is a farm and an industry based on farms with the problems that all kinds of farms have.
Well, Francesco, you talk about the surprise that green money, quote unquote, is flowing into this industry. And I was surprised watching the film about Italy's involvement. That's your home country of Italy. And you start the film there. And the idea that Italy being famous for its cuisine, that a lot of the seafood that is served in restaurants to tourists is coming from fish that are raised in farms. How extensive is fish farming in your home country of Italy?
In terms of consumption, the vast majority of fish that is eaten in the restaurants in the city along the coast of Italy are coming from sea farms, rather in Italy, more often from abroad. We're talking about sea that comes from other European countries, but also sea that comes from other countries all over the world. We have shrimp from Southeast Asia. We have salmon that is mostly produced in Norway. And so definitely most of the fish that you can eat there comes from farms, but this is not something that just while regarding the production is less present because the coast of Italy is very developed in terms of tourism, so they have not a lot of space to make the farms because the farms there are huge cages that can affect the landscape, so they import most of the production from other countries including Greece and Turkey, as I mentioned. But this is not something that is just concerning Italy. The matter is that worldwide, The farmed fish now when it comes to the consumption of fish, and the production and consumption of fish, the farmed fish is more than the total amount of catched fish. And this is something that is intended because, as I mentioned, the international institutions, including the FAO, are pushing for this development. They are pushing to further develop aquaculture because they say that this could be a way to go to as a solution to avoid overfishing because you know that most of our fishery are overfished, and they say, okay, we cannot catch more fish anymore, but we have to increase the consumption and the production because the global population is increasing, so we can farm it. And for this reason, they sell this industry as a sustainable solution, but it's not so the case.
Well, as your film definitely points out, if you're just joining us, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls One Planet series. We're very pleased to be joined by Francesco De Agostinis, a director of the documentary Until the End of the World, which explores the perils of industrial fish farming. And Francesco, when people go to restaurants, is there any way to see, or even at the grocery store, is there any way to see or understand if the fish is farmed as opposed to wild caught? Is there any obligation, even in places like Italy, where tourists are going to restaurants, to understand where their fish is coming from?
No, in the restaurants, you have no idea where your fish is coming from. In fact, when people go to the sea in coastal areas, in coastal cities, in coastal places, they always take the fish because they are at the sea, so they think they are eating local products, but they don't. They definitely don't. There is not. People always eat shrimps there, but there are not shrimps that are taken there locally. Most of them are imported from farms, some from somewhere else. And there is more transparency in supermarkets, no? Because there is some labels. There are some labels there that points out the origin of the fish. So there is a little bit more transparency there.
And Francesco, I suppose we should back up a little bit for those who aren't really familiar with fish farming, how it works. Can you just describe what a fish farm is? I mean, your documentary has really powerful visuals showing these facilities just right offshore, but just paint a picture of what a fish farm is, how it operates.
The fish farm, when you talk about aquaculture, you can talk about a lot of different things. The aquaculture terms includes the harvesting of algae and the production of shellfish. But the film focuses on marine fish farms. We're talking mostly about salmon, sea bream, and sea bass. And how does this work? There are these cages, open net cages that are put in the sea, in the open sea, and they put them there like hundreds of thousands of fish. So it's an intensive production. And when it comes to salmon, this fish is not a normal salmon. It's a salmon that is the result of years and years of genetic selection, exactly as it happened with the poultry, no? With the chickens. They are not chicken anymore now. They are broiler. The same happened with the salmon because these animals are engineered to grow faster, and so they are put in these cages. Depending on the species, it can be in the species it can be for 1 year or maybe 2 years. What happens in these cages? First of all, they are fed, artificially fed, of course, and this is one of the main problems because the feeds that are given to this fish, these species are always carnivorous species. When salmon is carnivorous, sea bream, sea bass, but also trouts, also shrimps, all of them are carnivorous. So they eat other fish. And the artificial feed that is given and is simply poured into these cages and is made of other fish that is catched somewhere else. So this is the first main problem, that you are not really approaching resolving overfishing because you are using more fish to produce the fields than the feed that than the fish that you're effectively producing the farms. So you are giving more burden to the global ecosystem. No, you are taking more fish than you are able to produce. And so, this, sorry.
So go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
No, and the these cages. The other problem is the pollution, the local pollution, because in Norway, in Greece, in Turkey, these cages are not in the open sea. In Chile as well, they are not in the open sea, or in they are in closed areas of sea because it's less expensive. Because if you put an open net in the open sea, then you will have a storm. You need be a very expensive technologies to put a farm in the open sea in offshore waters, because otherwise you will have storms that will destroy your facility. Instead, they put these farms in closed areas, in bays, archipelagos. For this reason, Greece, Turkey, they are perfect. The fjords in Norway, but also the fjords in British Columbia, for example. But this means pollution problems, because you put millions of fish farmed in closed areas of sea, and then you have the feces, you have the unneeded feed that goes into the ecosystem. It's like, it's exactly in the film we say that it's exactly like putting a poultry farm into the sea and having all the feces of the all the unit unneeded feed, all the also chemical things that you can give that pour into open waters. So we saw that the ecosystem, the local ecosystem, is always very affected. You can really see small dead zone in the area where there are a lot of fish farms. We saw this in Greece, but it is well documented also in other parts of the world, where, because simply the local system cannot bear such a huge population of fish. So this is, you have this problem of local pollution, plus the problem of the fish, plus the problem of the coastal impact. No, as you mentioned, in Italy there are no farms because the coasts are very relevant for tourism. But for example, in Greece, there are some places in Greece where the tourism is not so developed. But they still live out of tourism. But public authorities put their farms the same, and this is very affecting local economies, because they have real problems, because you cannot have tourism if you have, you know, factory farms in the sea. It's something that is totally in conflict, no?
Well, the visuals just from your documentary really show the local impact, the dead zone that you just described from these fish farm cages right offshore. And I'm wondering, in places like Greece, where, as you mentioned, these are areas that could be potential sites for tourism, but are going to become very unpalatable for people to see these fish farms and deal with those impacts. What are communities able to do to push back? And I imagine the same in Italy as well. What are the opportunities for communities to try to keep these fish farms out of their coastal areas?
The problem that we met is that so far the local communities have been very unable to challenge the growth of fish farms in their territories. In fact, we in the film we heard this word that was coming, that was colonialism. People in Greece was complaining about a colonialist system related to fish farms, because we have been in this island that is called Poros, that is not far from Athens, 2 hours ferry ride from Athens. And there, all the 4,000 people, local communities, say no to fish farms, except for like 10 people that work with the farms. And all of them said no, because they already have some small fish farms. And they saw the local impact in their waters. They have already some impact for their tourism economy. Their economy is totally based on tourism. Almost all of them work on tourism. And still there is a plan from the national government to increase the production there by 28 times. So it's a huge increase of production, and they are totally against it. Now, So far, the government was not even hearing that because there was so few attention to the matter. There was not a lot of understanding and knowledge of the problems related to fish farming. And when they had conferences at a national level, the message was always that fish farmers are a great solution for the blue transformation. So the government has to implement and make grow these farms. So of course the communities has no voice to say no. Now I just want to add that things are changing a little bit in Greece because so many communities. I've been there a few weeks ago. I've met like 15 communities, a meeting in Athens from all over the Greece, and they were aware of the problem. They began to work together, and now there is some kind of national debate. So maybe things could happen, but so far projects have been going ahead even when the communities were opposing it, because the government was very, very, very supporting this kind of production.
About industrial fish farming with Francesco Di Agostinis, director of the new documentary, Until the End of the World. We're going to have more on the subject just after this break, so stay with us. Kind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're talking about industrial fish farming and the new documentary, Until the End of the World, with Francesco Di Agostinis. And we're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us at 866-798-8255. You can also just leave a comment on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, for this segment, we'd like to open up the phone lines and hear from you. Do you buy farmed fish? Do you have concerns about factory fish farming? What would you like to see done? You can join a conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email with any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org, or you can also leave that comment at yourcallradio.org. Well, Francesco, glad you're staying with us, and wanted to ask about regulations on fish farming. We talked about the impacts and what it's doing to local communities, how the organizing is happening to try to push back, but what's the current regulatory environment? What are we seeing in terms of everything from that supply chain, the feed that they're harvesting, all the way up through the facilities themselves?
But there are different kind of regulations about the local impact. We have seen that, and I want to talk about the case of Norway, that is biggest producer of salmon, and it's a big exporter. Most of the salmon that reach the United States also comes from Norway. And there, just recently, there have been a public outrage about the conditions of the farms of the condition of the farming in the farming conditions, because they had this footage showing so many dead fish inside the cages. The numbers showed up that almost one out of six salmon, on average, in the farms in Norway, die in the farms before reaching before being harvested. This is huge, and I think that in no other livestock production you could have such a huge share of animals that die into the farm itself. And this is related to the poor welfare condition of the animals. And this is incredible because you are talking about Norway that is supposed to be the most regulated place. And in the documentary, you have this spokesperson from FAO that says that the regulation in Norway is very tight. But still, you have one out of six fish that die before reaching the harvesting. So it's like 60 million fish that die every year into the farms before being used. So it's also an incredible waste of fish and waste of feed, because this fish is well grown, that's been heating for years, for months before dying into the farms. And this is the excellence, the best practice. Then you have other countries, including Mediterranean countries, but also Chile, where, as the FAO spokesperson say in the documentary, the regulation is very, very weaker. Because these countries, to let the industry grow so fast, they also, closed an eye on the regulation. So, for example, in Greece, you really have these cages that are like 50, like a few meters out of the coast, very close to the coast. In Chile, you can find the farms so packed of fish. There are incredible, they are so intensive. There are incredible numbers of fish that have been farmed in one single operation. And of course, this led to more and more problems. They have had incredible problems with fish farms with salmon farms in Chile for diseases, for parasites, due to the lack of regulations. No, in fact, now the Argentina government looking at what happened in Chile, in the Chilean Patagonia, some time ago they decided to completely ban the farming of salmon in their waters. And this ban is also in California. For example, there is a ban to salmon farming, even if there is still this project to develop salmon farms in federal waters. It's a federal project. It's a national project. So there is no possibility to farm salmon in California, there could be some offshore farms that will be settled sooner or later, because there is this debate about the settling of new farms in offshore federal waters.
Francesco, I appreciate you walking through some of the regulatory environment here. It's so multifaceted given the different countries involved. And your documentary also takes us to a number of key places around the world. I wanted to start by asking about what you found when you traveled to the continent of Africa and the feed supply chain that you've talked about earlier. What exactly is happening in some of these fishing communities where they're paying for and producing the feed that is going to these industrial fish farm facilities?
Yes, thank you very much for your question. This is the most incredible part of the documentary, definitely. We reached Senegal to following the supply chain of this fish that is used to produce feeds for the farms in Europe. And we reached Senegal because the coast of West Africa, so different countries included Senegal, Mauritania, the Gambia, and also Morocco, they are witnessing now an incredible increase of factories producing fish meal and fish oil. How does this work? Along the west coast of Africa, you have this migratory routes of sardines fish, and this small pelagic fish is the fish that is used in West Africa and in South America to produce the feeds. So we have been seeing this increase of factories along the coast that are there to buy and catch the local sardines to produce meal to be used for feed. And this is really incredible because we met communities there that really cannot fish anymore. We have been on a small village a few kilometers north of Dakar, and we have been seeing with our own eyes that there were fishermen staying in the beach and playing football because they couldn't go anymore to the sea because there is no more fish. And so this is incredible because it's a contradiction. Now, this industry is supposed to be a solution for the overfishing, while they are fostering overfishing in places like Senegal, where there is such a food insecurity. It's incredible. And And we also seen this problem that also local fishermen sell their fish not to the local markets for the local consumers, but they prefer to sell the fish to the industries, to the fish meal industry, to the fish meal factories, because they pay better. They pay better than the local, you know, the local market, the women that sell at the local market. And another problem that adds on this is that fishermen, considering that this fish is intended to be sold to the factories, they also can fish the smaller fish that you couldn't fish if you are going to sell it to the market, because people wouldn't buy the smaller fish. The juvenile is called now the small fish. That is still too young to be eaten, but to make meal, to make a flour, you can definitely use any kind of fish. But this is something that is very dangerous, because it is not only overfishing, but it's also you are also preventing population for restoring, because you are taking the young fish, so really creating a problem to the ecosystem and to the local communities.
And Francesco, your film, of course, is called Until the End of the World, and we definitely want to explain to our listeners here why it's called that. You actually start your film at Punta Arenas in Chile's southernmost region, an area with what's called the last city on Earth. Can you talk about why you chose this place to begin the film and ultimately to title the film?
Yes, Punta Arenas is in the film is the last step of our journey. Why we traveled to Punta Arenas? We have been there because we were following the solution suggested by the industry to avoid this problem in West Africa. They are aware of the problems related to supplying fish in West Africa, and not only for sustainable reasons, but also because there is an economic problem, because fish meal is more and more expensive, and so they are actively looking for alternative raw materials to produce feeds, including vegetables like soy, for example, that is a big ingredient now in the salmon diets, the farmed salmon diets. But the problem is when you give vegetables to the fish as a feed, they can lack the omega-3. No? You know how is important the omega-3 for the consumer, for the consumers that buy the fish. They look for omega-3 so much. So the industry has to keep this omega-3 high. And the solution that they found was to go in the Southern Ocean to increase the fishing of krill. Krill is a small, is a kind of a shrimp, like a few inches long shrimp, and it's kind of the basis of the world food net in the Southern Ocean. Most of the wild population in the Southern Ocean rely on krill for their existence, including penguins, whales. Whales mostly eat krill, but also seabirds. So there are a lot of, most of the animals that you can find in the Southern Ocean and the Antarctica mainly eat krill. You know that the Southern Ocean is among the places that is more affected by climate change. So this krill population is already endangered by the climate change, because the situation in Antarctica is changing faster than anywhere else in the planet, and the industry, instead of being more careful about this so fragile ecosystem, it's also so symbolic ecosystem, we are trying to increase exponentially the catches of krill in that place. So this is, for me, really incredible, and this is the reason why we went to Punta Arenas in southern Chile to find out more, because there is a logistic base for these vessels that go fishing in Antarctica. So we were investigating this real sustainability of this activity. And of course, we met scientists in Punta Arenas that told us that they require that would that they, would, they ask for the creation of a lot of MPAs around Antarctica to protect us a so fragile ecosystem instead of increasing the fish, the fishing of krill. But you know, it's very political, so it's difficult to establish effective MPAs. There are a lot of projects to support the settling of MPAs in Antarctic peninsulas in different parts of Antarctic and the Southern Ocean, but there is a lot of opposition by different countries. Now, especially recently, especially by China and Russia that have a huge interest in krill, especially China, because also China is a main producer of aquaculture products. And
Francesco, there's a lot of companies as well that are behind where the governments are coming from on this issue. And I know one of the surprising things watching this film, at least for me, was just the fact that we don't even know the names of some of these companies that are involved in what is truly a multi-billion, a multinational industry. Can you talk about some of the big players involved? What are the companies? Avramar, for example, in Spain. Can you talk about that company's involvement and the investors behind all of this?
Yes, we took the case of Avramar because we focused on the Mediterranean region, but also because it's an interesting example of how this is not about small farmers that produce their own fish in an unsustainable manner. This is not at all the case. The fish farming is mainly operated by big companies, or in the case of Avramar, by private equity funds. Avramar represents around 70% of all the production of fish, of farmed fish in Greece. And the company is owned by two private equity funds. One is Amerra, that is based in the United States, and the other one is Mudabala, which is based in the United Arab Arab Emirates. And interestingly, this means two things. From one side, most of these operations are intended just to make a short-term profit. They are not looking for a long-term production sustainability. They really don't care about that. They also told me in a undercover investigation, the Amerra admitted that they were looking for a short-term profit. They were looking for increase the production and then sell out their assets. And it's interesting also because they have some kind of power. Because, for example, we have met in Greece that Avramar was a partnership, for example, with the U.S. embassy there for supporting their projects. Because you know there was an interest by a private equity fund, and at the same time we are witnessing Avramar that was agreeing some public programs in the U.S. to encourage the increase of consumption of fish. That is something that is very incredible for us. Now, for example, there is a program that was partnered by Avramar itself, and they were trying to suggest a canteen from university across the U.S. To increase the consumption of fish from the Mediterranean. And of course, we are talking about farmed fish. So it's important to know more about this, but you know, when it comes to food system, you always have this problem that you have these producers of feeds, of raw materials that are quite invisible. Now, you know, there are very few players in the food system that are very central, but they are almost invisible. You just see the labels of the final producers, but who, you know, who deals with the grains, and the seeds. They are just a few companies are well known for people who works on this matter, but the normal consumer don't know anything about that.
Well, your documentary, I think, is taking a good step towards remedying that situation. And we're joined by Francesco De Agostinis, director of Until the End of the World. This is Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar on Your Calls One Planet series. We're talking about industrial fish farming and its impact all around the world. And we've just got a few minutes left, Francesco. So I wanted to ask about solutions to this problem. What needs to be done? It seems like maybe we do want to see more wild-caught fish, because even though we've got this overfishing problem, given the local challenges you're describing, or is there something that could be done maybe to reduce demand overall, or do we need to regulate this fish farm industry to make sure it performs better and has better environmental outcomes? What are some of the solutions that we should be thinking about?
Thank you for the question. I think that all the things that you said are part of the solutions. What we focus, especially the message of the film, focuses especially on the reduction, because the thesis behind all of this, the thesis that FAO gave to us, the UN give always, is that we have to nourish an increasing global population, so we have to increase the production if we want to keep the same average consumption. But this is impossible, because you have not enough fish to keep the same consumption. So first of all, I think it's fundamental to reduce the consumption, especially in Europe and in North America, because we are huge consumers of fish. And also in the United States now, there have been a huge increase of consumption in recent years, probably as an effect of the campaigns that I mentioned before. But in Europe, it's quite stable, but in Italy, we are among the biggest consumers of fish in general.
Well, and how do you do that, Francesco? That's a tall order to get people to change their habits. Is it done through pricing or consumer awareness campaigns? What could reduce demand?
I think it's both of them, because you cannot increase prices if you don't have awareness among the people. So you should probably have a better regulation that include. I mean, this applies for many productions. Food productions, when a production is not so sustainable, you need a regulation that include that footprint in the final cost of the product. No, in that case, you will have fish more expensive probably, but you will consume less because it will be maybe a local wild caught fish from a real artisanal fishery. So it's obvious that it must cost a little bit more, but you cannot do such a legislation if you don't have some awareness from the people, because they wouldn't understand. People would just think that we are talking about new taxes. I don't know. Something that is so you must make people understand that this kind of consumption, but this can apply with meat as well. No? Of course, all of us should reduce our meat consumption, but we must also understand why we should do that, and then we could be more willing of that.
Mm-hmm. And what about other solutions then? Besides reducing demand, is there a way that we could have industrial or factory fish farming that is not so harmful?
But I mean, when it comes to carnivorous fish, I would say no. I don't really see a solution. I've been working a lot on salmon farming. I don't think there could be a solution way to make a salmon farm. Maybe a salmon could be better than a cow in terms of footprint, but I totally don't think. As I mentioned, there could be other productions that could be less impactful, less harmful to the environment. Maybe, when it comes to aquaculture, you can talk about algae production, shellfish production. There are also some fish that is farmed in a small scale for facilities. And there are some species that rely there are some also innovative methods to make ecosystem farming. You know, there could be some kind of production. I want to mention that there is a coalition of groups in the US that it's called Don't Cage Our Oceans, that they support solutions. They are against fish farming, but try to find out possible solutions to have a sustainable kind of farming. So I think that there could be to some extent, but anything of this can work with the actual consumption level.
We'll try to put a link to that organization on our website for listeners who want to learn more. We're just about out of time, Francesco, but I just want to ask you, what's next for you? What's the next project in the works for you?
But I'm working, I'm beginning, very beginning, to work on a new project that is very similar in some part of the contents, that is about the rational use of food resources. Because, you know, I want to debunk this idea that we don't have enough food to feed the growing population in 2050. I don't agree at all. I'm not the only one. There are experts that say that we already have enough food for everyone. We just have to use it better. So I hope that the next documentary will talk about solutions, showing how to use better the resources that we already have.
Well, we look forward to having you on once that project is out. Wish you luck with that in the meantime. Francesco De Agostinis, director of Until the End of the World, an award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker. Thank you so much for coming on Your Calls One Planet series and for your work. Again, congratulations.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. It was great to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. And feel free to email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Lauren Schechter is our social media producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and it's Your Call.